You're listening to a Bible study by Jack Kelly. For more free Bible study resources, visit our website at gracethroughfaith.com.
Okay, Daniel chapter 6. Now, you understand that as we closed up in chapter 5, we saw the fulfillment of the prophecy that Daniel had made to King Nebuchadnezzar about almost 70 years earlier, in the second year of Nebuchadnezzar's term, when he had the dream of the statue. And remember, the statue had the head of gold and the chest and silver and the belly and thighs of bronze and the legs of iron and the feet of iron mixed with clay. And Daniel had told him that this was represented the four major kingdoms that would rule the earth, the Gentile kingdoms that would rule the earth from that point on until the end of the age, when a fifth kingdom would come, the kingdom of the Lord, and that kingdom would last forever. And so Nebuchadnezzar, thinking like most rulers would, that his kingdom would never end, built this great statue, you remember, and he built the whole thing of gold as if the whole statue was him. And so in Daniel chapter 5 then, after Nebuchadnezzar has died, his grandson presided over the defeat, really, of the Babylonian kingdom. And so with the end of chapter 5, we had the prophecy fulfilled. The head of gold is now gone. And now it's the chest of silver. And this represents the Media-Persia coalition. In a couple hundred years, Alexander the Great's going to come along. He represents the belly and thighs of bronze. And he's going to rule, and his successors after him, until finally the Romans come. They are the legs of iron. The Roman kingdom, you know, Roman Empire, two legs, if you will, the Eastern and the Western, and they ruled. And they never really were totally defeated in the classical sense. Components of the Roman Empire kind of clung together, that the Roman Empire reinvented itself, became the Holy Roman Empire, and components of it have ruled on until this day. And so the prophecy of the statue indicated that at the end of the age, this Roman Empire would come back together again in the 10 toes, the feet of clay and the toes of iron mixed with clay. And you'd have this revival of this Roman Empire coming back together at the end of the age. Some people see the European Union as the fulfillment of that prophecy. But back in Daniel, all he saw was the first cycle of this, the first changing of the guard, if you will, from Babylon, the head of gold, to Media-Persia. And so in Daniel chapter 6, now as we begin, we're going to see the Persian kingdom, and we're going to learn something about that and something about how Daniel has to do with affecting the rulership of the Media-Persia kings. You know that the Persians are the ancestors of the Iranians, and that the people from Media, I'll call them, they are today's Kurds. And so when you hear the talk about the Kurds in the news, you know that Turkey, for example, just attacked the Kurds living in Iraq, because Turkey is fearful that something's going to happen and the Kurds are going to get a homeland out of all of this. Now, the only problem with that is that some of the Kurds live in Turkey, some of the Kurds live in Iran, and some of the Kurds live in Iraq. And their homeland, if you will, their ancestral land, the land that belonged to the Media half of the Media-Persian coalition, that homeland is today partly in Iraq, partly in Iran, and partly in Turkey. And both Iran and Turkey are very much opposed to the Kurds getting any kind of strength that would lead to them developing some kind of a nationalistic movement that would end in a homeland for the Kurds. And so Turkey has, depending on whose reports you read, somewhere between 50,000 and 150,000 troops on the northern border of Iraq, and they've sent several thousand of them across the border, and there's fighting going on right now between the Turks and the Kurds. And the battle is to try and defeat any kind of a feeling among the Kurds that they might be able to take advantage of this opportunity to have a homeland of their own. one of the big deals about the Kurdish area of northern Iraq is that there are huge oil reserves there. And so if the Kurds were able to successfully lay claim to that, they would have the money that they would need to fund this nationalistic movement. And so Turkey has wanted that those oil reserves for themselves. And so they are going to try and get it at the expense of the Kurds. And of all the things, one of the Muslim Shiite clerics in Iraq has warned the Turks to stay away from the Kurds. And so this guy, his name is Sader. And he was, at the very beginning of the Iraqi war, he was a very powerful force. And they got him to agree to surrender and for his people to stop fighting and to not be involved in this. And for some period of time, over a year, he did that. Well, now he's decided, no, he's not going to do that anymore. And now he's one of the major combatants against the U.S. and Iraqi interests in gaining peace in Iraq. A portion of the city of Baghdad is called Sader City. That's where his hangout is, and that's where he's very strong. And oddly enough, he's come out, the Kurds are his enemies, but the Turks are more so. And so he's come out and warned the Turks against getting too aggressive against the Kurds. Now, I don't know what he's going to do about it, but it just shows you that if you don't like what's happening in Iraq, you just wait a little while and it'll change. And so, but that's way off our story. The Medes and the Persians were the ancestors of the Iranians and the Kurds, and they're the ones who have now conquered Babylon, and they're the ones who have now taken charge of the great city of Babylon. And so as we open up with chapter 6, we have the first glimpse, if you will, of the Medo-Persian Empire and its rule, several hundred years, 300 years, I think, rule over over what used to be called the Babylonian Empire. Now, the Medes were at the beginning the stronger part of this coalition, but the Persians developed strength and kind of overpowered the Medes, and so many people call this period of time the time of the Persian Empire. And so the Medes kind of get they get dropped off the title because the Persians became the really powerful force here. But at the beginning, it was the Medes who were the powerhouse, and they're the ones that put all this together and got the idea in their minds that they could conquer Babylon. All right, so they have been camped outside the city of Babylon. You remember the story from last time how they. Now they snuck under the gates, opened up the main gates to the city. They came through the river after they had redirected the waters. And so they came through at the bottom of the riverbed and under the city walls and opened up the main gates of the city and let everybody in. And they conquered the impregnable fortress of Babylon without a battle. The only casualty that we read about here is Belshazzar himself, who was the son of the king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar's grandson. And you remember how a few days later, as we close up last time, you remember how a few days later, King Cyrus of Persia came into the city and asked for the person in charge. Daniel came out. Daniel had been made the third highest ruler of the kingdom, and the first two were gone. And so now he is in charge. He comes out to greet Cyrus. He read to him a portion of Isaiah 44 and 45, which foretold how Cyrus would conquer Babylon, mentioned him by name 150 years before he was born, and it impressed Cyrus to such an extent that he agreed to free the Jews, which is what the Lord had called him to do. If you remember our reading of Isaiah 44 and 45, that the Lord had chosen Cyrus to be the person who would free the Jews from the 70-year Babylonian captivity. And so he had done that, and he opened up the museum. Remember how Belshazzar had taken the golden goblets and the silver goblets and things from the museum, the things that his grandfather Nebuchadnezzar had taken from the temple in Jerusalem and brought down and put it in the museum. Belshazzar had taken them out, and they were drinking toast to their pagan gods with them when the handwriting on the wall appeared, and that was the end of the Babylonian kingdom. Well, King Cyrus, having inherited all this by right of conquerorship, gave all that stuff back to the Jews, freed them to go back and rebuild Jerusalem, gave them letters of a guarantee of protection when they did so, gave them other incentives, money, for example, to be able to go back and rebuild the temple and resettle Jerusalem. Its 70 years had been served, and now, in accordance with the Lord's promise to them, he was freeing them to bring them back. And so all this is happening now as we begin in chapter 6, and we'll see what chapter 6 has to say to us. In verse 1, we read, it pleased Darius. Now remember, he's the Mede in the coalition. Cyrus is the Persian, Darius is the Mede. Darius is the son-in-law of Cyrus. They're joined together through the marriage. It pleased Darius to appoint 120 satraps. These are like governors or provincial controllers, to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. Now, this is a fascinating thing because, Daniel had really made a hit with Cyrus when he showed him the prophecy of Isaiah 45. And so impressed him that Daniel did something that hardly anybody ever does. He went from being the leader of the conquered people to joining the leadership of the conquerors. It's hard to do that, because usually when you're on the losing side and you're a leader, off with your head. But what he did, Cyrus actually brought him into the new government and made him one of the three who oversaw these 120 provinces of the kingdom of Babylon. His job was to make sure that there was no graft or corruption in the governments, that King Cyrus and Darius got all the money that they were supposed to get from the taxes they levied and from the charges and other things they were able to make. And so these three, one of whom is Daniel, was responsible for keeping everything square and everybody doing what they're supposed to be doing. Now it says in the second half of verse 2 here, the satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Verse 3, now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. So Daniel's about to get promoted here again, and he will, in effect, be number 2 now over even those people with whom he's currently serving. Verse 4, at this, the administrators and the satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Now, I wonder how many of us could stand such a test. If you read carefully, you'll find there are two people in the Bible, only two, about whom the Lord never has anything bad to say. Only two. One was Joseph, who ran Egypt, and one was Daniel, who ran Babylon. And so those are the only two that the Lord never found any fault with. And so if you know the story of Joseph and how he got into Egypt and how he rose from being a prisoner to being the prime minister, basically, of Egypt, and if you know the story of Daniel, who went from being a hostage to being the prime minister of Babylon, if you know something about their lives, you know that the Lord has pretty high standards, because these two men lived absolutely exemplary lives, and there was nothing that could be said against them. And even their enemies couldn't find anything to charge them for. Now, I don't see that in today's political climate, do you? I don't see any... I don't see any of our country's leaders about whom no fault can be found even by their enemies. And so that shows you how remarkable this is and how unique it was for this to happen. But the others are of course, they're jealous of Daniel because, first of all, he's not one of them. He's not one of the Persians. He's not one of the Medes. He's one of the conquered people, and he was a slave in their economy. And so they're jealous, and they're trying to find a way to bring him down. Verse 5 now, finally, these men said, we'll never find any basis for charges against this man Daniel unless it has something to do with the law of his God. And so there's a left-handed compliment for you. They're saying that Daniel is so honest and he's so trustworthy and he's so faithful to God that the only way we're going to get something on him is to make it a crime for him to worship his own God. And that's exactly what they set up here. Verse 6, so the administrators and the satraps went as a group to the king and said, O King Darius, live forever. The royal administrators, prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or man during the next 30 days, except to you, O king, will be thrown into the lion's den. So there's the trap. They're going to trap Daniel by making it illegal to pray to anyone except the king, and they just know Daniel is going to disobey this. We could derail the study right now and get into a discussion about whether God is in favor of civil disobedience. You know, the Bible says in several places, the book of Romans, for example, that our leaders have been placed over us by God, and he's going to hold them accountable, and our job is to obey. And if they're not honest and if they're not trustworthy, that's between them and God. We still need to obey. And Paul says, if you owe taxes, pay your taxes. If you owe this, do this. If you're required to perform public service, perform your public service, because these men have been placed over you by the Lord himself, and they will be held accountable for what they've done. But there are a couple of cases, and two of them are here in the book of Daniel, where he seems to condone civil disobedience, and it has to do with worshiping somebody besides him. You remember in chapter 2 when the three boys refused to bow down before the statue? That's worshiping, and they refused to worship that statue, and that's why they got thrown in the fiery furnace, and of course the Lord came and rescued them. Now, these administrators are going to try the same trick on Daniel. They're going to make it illegal for him to worship, to pray to his God. And we'll see what happens. Now, right away, you will notice that they start off by misrepresenting the case, right? Because they say in verse 7 that all of them have agreed. All of the administrators, the prefects, satraps, advisors, and governors have agreed. Well, all but one is what they should have said. Because they didn't get Daniel to agree to this. He doesn't even know about this. As you're going to see, he gets taken by surprise by all of this. So now verse 8. Now, O king, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered in accordance with the laws of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be repealed. So King Darius put the decree in writing. Now, it's interesting that somewhere in the history, I don't know exactly how this came to be, but somewhere in the history of this coalition, the leadership persuaded one of the kings to make a law binding on his successors that anything that the king put in writing could not be repealed. Once he put it in writing, not even the king could disobey the law. And that's what they're saying here. This is according to the tradition of the Medes and Persians, which means once you put this in writing, king, not even you can repeal it. It's the law, period. And so, verse 9 says, King Darius put the decree in writing. Verse 10, now when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, you see, he only found out about it after the fact. When he learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room, where the windows opened toward Jerusalem. And three times a day, he got down on his knees and prayed, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. And verse 11 says, when these men went in as a group and found Daniel praying and asking God for help. And so they went to the king and spoke to him about his royal decree. Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or man except you, O king, would be thrown into the lion's den? And the king answered, the decree stands in accordance with the laws of the Medes and Persians, which cannot be repealed. He's going to wish he didn't say that. And then they said to the king, this is verse 13, Daniel, who's one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, nor to the decree you put in writing. He still prays three times a day. And when the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. Isn't that amazing? The king knows he's been had, and he knows just who has had him. But they just show that their lack of respect for Daniel by saying, Daniel, one of the exiles. They didn't say, President Daniel, our boss. They didn't say, Daniel, the one you've chosen personally to run all the affairs of the kingdom. What they said was, Daniel, one of the exiles from Judah. And so he sees what's going on here. He sees that he's been had. He's upset, but he's not upset with Daniel. He's upset with what has transpired here and how he's been drawn into it. Now, I want to back up a little bit and let's see. I think there's an interesting verse in 2 Chronicles 6 that we want to look at here to show you what Daniel was doing and why. 2 Chronicles 6, which is written about the same period of time, and it's verse 36. 2 Chronicles 6, 36. This is the, while the Chronicles were written about the same period of time, there were history even in Daniel's time. And so chapter 6 is largely made up of Solomon's prayer to God at the time of the dedication of the temple. He makes this big prayer, and we're not going to read the whole prayer because it starts in verse 12 and it keeps on going after what we want to see. We just want to see verse 36 and a few verses afterwards. 2 Chronicles 6, 36. When they sin against you, speaking of the Israelites, here Solomon says something that's, of course, still true today. Probably not among any of us, but the rest of the world is still guilty of all this. He said, when they sin against you, for there is no one who does not sin. I want you to remember that carefully. There was no one who does not sin. And you become angry with them and give them over to the enemy who takes them captive to a land far away or near. And if they have a change of heart in the land where they're held captive and repent and plead with you in the land of their captivity and say, we have sinned, we have done wrong and acted wickedly. And if they turn back to you with all their heart and soul in the land of their captivity where they were taken and pray toward the land you gave their fathers, toward the city you have chosen and toward the temple I have built for your name. Then from heaven, your dwelling place, hear their prayer and their pleas and uphold their cause and forgive your people who have sinned against you. And so this is Solomon interceding well in advance for his own people, saying, Lord, I know that the day is going to come when they're going to sin against you, and they're going to make you so angry that you're going to actually kick them out of the land for a while. And when that happens, if they face your city and fall on their knees and offer prayers of repentance, please, hear their prayers and forgive them. And of course, this is what Daniel is doing because the 70 years are up and it's time for the Jews to be freed. And he has been praying now. If you look at the chronology, you start with Daniel. When we get to Daniel chapter 9, we're going to be going back to the time when Daniel started praying. And it appears that he started praying 2 to 3 years before the 70 years were up. And he prayed faithfully, 3 times a day, every day, for his people. And we're going to read one of his prayers, and we're going to learn some interesting things about it as we do. You remember I mentioned last time that the first 6 chapters of the book of Daniel are about his life. And they run as a story, a narrative, from the time he's young to the time he's old. And then the last six chapters, 7 through 12, are prophetic. They're prophecies that Daniel received along the way. And so what the book turns out to be is in the first 6 chapters, it's just the flow of his life. And then the last 6 chapters, he actually goes back and tells you about prophecies he learned during the period of his life. And so chapter 9, for example, takes place before chapter 6. Chapter 7, which we're going to take up next time, takes place before chapter 5. And we're going to see all this. And what Daniel did is when he wrote the book, he didn't want to interrupt the flow of his life narrative. And so he put all the prophecies, all the important prophecies that the Lord showed him in the last half of the book and used the first half to give a sort of continuous flow, chronological flow of his life. But he started praying 3 years before Cyrus came. And we're going to read one of those prayers when we get to chapter 9. And apparently he's still doing this because he's still bowing down. He's still facing the land. He's still praying toward the city of Jerusalem. And this time he got caught. And the people have set him up because they knew he was going to do this. And they've set up the king against him. And so right about now, the administrators are thinking, well, we got this one in the bag. There's no way out for him now. Not even the king can save him. Okay, we go to verse 15 now. Now remember, verse 14 says the king made every effort until sundown to save him. He worked all through the day. But now it's the end of the day. And then verse 15 says, the men went as a group to the king and said to him, remember, O king, that according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed, as if he needed reminding. And so the king gave the order. Now I want you to pay attention to how this king feels about doing this. The king gave the order, verse 16 says, and they brought Daniel and threw him into the lion's den. And the king said to Daniel, may your God, whom you serve continuously, rescue you. Now, that's not exactly how it reads in the original language. There's an issue here in the way the original wording is written that causes some people who know a lot more about the language than I do. And remember, this part of Daniel is written in Aramaic, the language of the Babylonians. And some people who know a lot more about this language than I do indicate that the king's words to Daniel denote a sense of obligation on God's part to rescue Daniel. And so it probably would read more accurately to say, the king said to Daniel, your God, whom you served continually, must rescue you. You see, Darius believed that God was obligated to save Daniel because of the covenant that existed between them. And some commentators believe that Darius was actually watching this closely to see whether God would be as faithful to Daniel in maintaining the covenant as Daniel had been to God. And so he is going to set this up now so that nobody can tinker with this. He's got a living experiment here. And he's going to set this up so that nobody can tinker with it. Nobody can manipulate the results. And so as Daniel goes into the lion's den, Darius is there. And he says, like we read, may your God, whom you serve continually, may he rescue you. Verse 17, a stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den. And the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the rings of his nobles so that Daniel's situation might not be changed. Now, unless you were reading this carefully and had some of this perspective, you might think that, well, the king's changed his mind. He's in on it. He wants to make sure Daniel gets his. But no, that's not the case. He's sealing the tomb not to keep Daniel in, but to make sure nobody else can mess with it. And he puts his own seal on it, and then he calls all these nobles around who've accused Daniel, and he makes them put their seal on it as well. Because if any of these seals are broken, when he comes back in the morning, he's going to know that they've manipulated the result, and then he's going to find out by the broken seal who was responsible. And so he's sort of saying to them, okay, you caught me in this, and I don't think you're going to be successful here. I believe Daniel's God is going to rescue him, and I'm going to make sure you guys can't do anything to mess that up. You with me? See how he's got that set up? Now, verse 18 says, and then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating and without any entertainment being brought to him, and he could not sleep. The without eating is again, one of these things that probably means more than just didn't have any appetite for dinner. Some people believe that the language really implies that the king is fasting on Daniel's behalf because he not only doesn't eat, but he doesn't want any diversion either. I mean, if you and I were in a tough spot, and we had all of the resources of the wealthiest kingdom in the world at our fingertips to distract us and to cause us to try and take our minds off our troubles, we'd probably take advantage of that. But this king doesn't want to be distracted from this. He doesn't want any dinner, and he doesn't want anything to distract him during the night. And it says he couldn't sleep. He was up all night. I am one of those who is leaning toward the idea that Darius is, is interceding for Daniel, which is an amazing thing if you stop to think about it. But when you put all the little clues we get in these verses together, it makes sense. He tried everything he could to save him from going in there. He failed at that. He feels guilty because he got tricked into doing this. And now his most trusted person is going to pay the penalty for it. But he knows that Daniel has this covenant with God. And he knows how faithful Daniel has been to this. He knows how faithful Daniel has been to the responsibilities that the king himself has given him. He knows that the guy just never does anything wrong. He always does the right thing. And so he thinks that God will save him. And he's going to make sure that God gets a fair chance to do so. That's the way kings think, you know. Okay, verse 19 now. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den. And when he came near to the den, he called to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lion?" And Daniel answered, "O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions, and they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I ever done any wrong before you, O king." All right. You can imagine how Darius feels now. He's been vindicated. He has seen his experiment come to its conclusion, and the conclusion has been positive. And Darius is speaking more strongly about God this morning than he has in the past. I mean, your God, the living God. And you see, this was a very important term in Old Testament times. God is called by many the living God, because all other nations worshiped gods that were just idols. No other nation had seen a God perform the way the God of the Jews had performed. No other nation had been spoken to by its gods the way the Israelites were spoken to by their God. And so he became known, God became known among the nations. The God of the Jews was called the living God, as opposed to these idols that we have, these statues and representations. They have a real God, and he is a living God. The question is, why didn't he accept God? I think when we read his declaration at the end of the chapter here, we're gonna see that there's a fair chance that he did. Before we get to that, let me ask you this question, because, as you know, these things are put in the Bible not just because they're cute stories. And of course, anybody who knows anything at all about the Bible probably knows the story of the three boys in the fiery furnace and Daniel in the lion's den. Those are two big ones, aren't they? And we hear about them a lot. But they're more than just cute stories. They're more than just inspirational stories, and they're more than just a demonstration of a person's relationship with God. These events obviously are put here for our learning. Remember how Paul said in one of his letters, everything that was written before time was written for our learning, so that we, through patience and endurance of the Scriptures, might have hope. I think that's Romans 15:4. Let's find out, because I don't want to give you the wrong verse. There's only two places where it can be, and that's one of them. Yeah, it's 15:4, Romans. "For everything that was written in the past was written to teach us, so that through endurance and the encouragement of the Scriptures, we might have hope." That's a good memory verse, isn't it? And it also tells you that the Old Testament's got some good stuff in it for you. that we don't have to be New Testament Christians like so many are. We can be Bible Christians, because there's easily as much for us in the Old Testament as there is in the New. And so we're supposed to get some examples, some lesson out of this that's relative to us. We're not just supposed to look at this and say, "Wow, wasn't God great for Daniel, and wasn't Daniel a faithful guy, and to deserve to have something like that done for him?" But you see, I'm of the opinion that what Daniel went through this night has great lessons for us, because I believe this event here could easily be in a small sense a microcosm of the life of a believer. Because you see, in 1 Peter, I think it is, we're told that the devil goes around like a roaring lion looking for people to devour, right? Well, who do you think he was talking about? Who are the people the devil's going around like a roaring lion looking to devour? The believers, yeah, we're the ones. And so if these lions are in some way representative of the devil, Daniel stuck in there in the midst of them, then he must be somehow representative of us, because those lions were after him, just like the devil as a lion is after us. And Daniel's sitting there by himself. He's at least 75. No, he's at least 85 years old. 85. He's already lived three times as long as the average Egyptian. He's 85 years old, and he's sitting there in the midst of these hungry lions. When did he know for sure that they were not going to eat him? When did he know for sure? When he walked out. He believed it when he walked in, right? But he knew for sure when he walked out. Okay? What do they say? Science learns through observation. A scientist can't make, or shouldn't make, I'll say, because they do, a scientist shouldn't make any statement about something he hasn't personally observed. And so, from a scientific standpoint, Daniel knew that the lions weren't going to eat him when he walked out. Every moment during the night could have been the moment when they decided, okay, this is enough, let's get this guy. Daniel didn't have to have faith for a minute, or an hour, or even a couple of hours. He had to have faith for the entire night. He had a moment-by-moment faith that was unshakable. Every moment, every time a lion moved, every time a lion took a breath or opened his mouth or yawned or blinked, Daniel had to have faith that that lion was not getting ready to attack him. You know, we have grown up in a society where television is the number one curriculum. It was true in our age, it's even more so now. But you know, the average kid spends about 4 or 5 or 6 times as much time in front of a television during his first 18 years as he does in front of a teacher. And so television is the first curriculum. And the big thing that television has taught us is that all the world's problems can be solved in 30 minutes with 3 commercial breaks. Because show after show after show, when we were growing up, that's the way it happened. They start the show with a problem. 30 minutes later, the problem's solved. They've had the commercials in the meantime, and everybody's happy. There's resolution to everything, just like that. And then along comes McDonald's. And they say, you want something to eat? You can have it right now. You don't have to wait. Have it right now. And then comes the microwave oven. Now you don't have to go to McDonald's to have your food right now. You can take it out of the freezer, put it in the oven, have it right now. And let me tell you how frustrated some people get standing in front of the microwave for 45 seconds, waiting for their dinner. That's right. We all do. We want our problem solved right now. Now, remember what I said. I said when Daniel went into the lion's den, he believed that God was going to save him. But he didn't know from experience until he came out. In other words, knowing and believing are not the same thing. Because when you know that that chair will hold you up. Because you've sat in it. You have experience. Now, before you ever sat in the chair, you looked at it and you believed it would hold you. And you believed strongly enough so that you were willing to sit down in it. But you didn't know that chair would hold you until you sat in it. Until you actually experienced it. That's when you knew it. You remember I gave you the definition of knowledge is know from observation. The scientific knowledge can only come from observation. In other words, until you experience something, you don't know it. That's the context in which I'm using the word know. He knew it once he had experienced it. But he only believed it up until then. It's just like the chair. You have very strong faith that the chair will hold you. But until you've sat in it, you don't know from experience that it will hold you. You just believe it will. And that's a big difference. It says, God sent his angel and he shut the mouths of the lions. Now, we don't know whether there was a physical manifestation of an angel. That certainly would have helped things if he had an angel sitting there beside him all night, like what's her name on Touched by an Angel? If Tess had sat there with him all night, that would have made it a lot easier. We don't know that happened. All we know is that Daniel said God sent an angel. Now he could have been referring to the fact that the angel came unseen, and from the looks of things, Lord, having sat there all night and seen the lions didn't move, must have been God had them clamp their mouths shut. We don't know that for sure. The only thing I'm, and please don't try and make too much of this, the only thing I'm trying to say is, this is a story about faith. It's a story about faith, not knowledge. There wasn't anything guaranteeing Daniel's safety in that lion's den, and there wasn't anything that he could do personally to improve his situation. He was totally at the mercy, if you will, of the event. He's 85 years old. He's sitting there in the dark in this den of lions. He has no ability at all. He has only his faith. Okay? Can we buy that? All right. Now, the reason I'm getting into all this is because that is you and me. We don't have any experience that tells us in advance how our life is going to come out. And when all is said and done, we don't have any ability to control that, because there's a whole lot more of our life that happens due to circumstances beyond their control than there is that happens due to things that we do. Anybody who says he's a self-made man, for example, is telling a big lie, because there aren't any self-made men. There are men who work hard and are blessed, but there are a whole lot more men who work hard and are not. Like I've said before, there's only two things you're guaranteed for working hard all your life. One is you're going to get old, and the other is you're going to get tired. Everything else has to do with a lot of other circumstances. But what I want you to understand here is that I believe this story of Daniel in the lion's den is a model of our life here on earth. There is a powerful force aligned against us, and he's looking for any chance he can get to devour us, and it's by the grace of God that he doesn't. It's because of our faith that he doesn't. Because I will suggest to you that although Daniel lived an exemplary life, and although he was witness to some of the great works of God in history, he himself did not have the knowledge of God and of God's character and of God's purpose that you and I have, because he did not have this experience of seeing God become a man and come to earth and die for the sins of the people. And so he didn't know as much about God as we do. And if he could manifest that kind of faith, then it seems like we should be able to trust him through the night of our lives. And if we could use his experience as a model, as a source of inspiration, as a source of strength, then I believe we will have received the lesson from the story. Because we sit there in the dark night of our life, and we can see the eyes of the lions, and we know their intent is to devour us. But the scriptures tell us that we've got somebody standing between us and them. And he has already proved that he will give his life in exchange for ours. And we need to look at that closely in the context of our faith and say, if Daniel could believe all that, only having seen what little of God that he had seen, how much more should we be able to believe that, knowing God from what we have seen? But yet we all look at, just one sec, yet we all look at the story and say, oh, what great faith he had. I wish I had faith like that. The first duty of a believer is to believe. It goes with the job. It is the job. In fact, I was answering a question in one of the emails I get. The idea was, some people are better than others, and so why should they all suffer the same punishment just because they didn't choose the Lord? And why people live exemplary lives, but they just don't become believers. And why should they be punished the same way that Hitler and Jeffrey Dahmer, you know the names they always come up with on these things? And I got to thinking about that, and it seems to me that relativity of good and evil is man's idea, not God's. If you net it out in the scriptures, you and I are in the same position as Adam and Eve. We've been given one rule, and that's all. talk all you want about the commandments, talk all you want about the admonitions to live a good life and all this and that and everything. We've been given one rule, one thing God requires of us, just like he only required of Adam and Eve, one thing. He told them, have anything you want anywhere in the garden, but stay away from that tree. One rule, they broke it. Well, turn with me to John 6:28 for a second. And I'm going to show you we got one rule. 6:28. Then they asked him, this is the crowd talking to Jesus, they asked him, what must we do to do the works God requires? Isn't that a beautiful question? And didn't the Lord have a perfect opportunity there to start listing all the things? I mean, they left themselves wide open on this, didn't they? He could have started with the Ten Commandments. Then he could have given him the Sermon on the Mount again. Then he could have given him all of Paul's epistles with all the victorious life and all the do's and don'ts and all the things that come that we're supposed to do out of gratitude for our being saved. But he didn't. He says in verse 29, Jesus answered, the work of God is this, to believe in the one he sent. Period. That sounds to me like we've been given one responsibility, one rule. Just like Adam and Eve were not to eat from the tree of good and evil, we are to believe in the one that God has sent. That's what God requires. And so if that's the case, and I'm still working on this, but if that's the case, then in the Bible when it says that at the end of the age, the dead will be resurrected and everyone will be judged according to his works, maybe that doesn't mean how good a life we lived. Maybe it means whether we did the work that God requires of us or not. And maybe there is no difference between the admired non-believer philanthropist and the reviled mass murderer if they both neglected to do the one thing that God requires. And so much is made about we're under grace, not under the law. We talk about the 613 commandments in the Old Testament, and boy, isn't it much better that we're in the age of grace now, and we don't have to worry about all those things. Well, you haven't read the Sermon on the Mount if you're relieved by that, because the 613 commandments were all based on action. But the Sermon on the Mount says if you even think about one of these things, you're guilty. So they had to control their behavior. We have to control our thoughts if we're going to obey the law. I think that the first and primary purpose of our life is to make our decision about Jesus. That's what we're here for. We're here to make our decision about Jesus. Once we've done that, then we're here to glorify him. That's our second. But if you don't do the first one, it doesn't matter what else you do. Nothing else matters. And after you do the first one, nothing else matters. I mean, there's just that one thing. We are here to decide whether we're going to let God's death pay the price for our sin. Once you do that one thing, then there are crowns you can earn, there are rewards you can go after, you can lay up treasures in heaven, you can do all those things, but you can't do any of that until you do that one thing. Here we were in verse 21. Daniel answered, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lion. And they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in his sight, nor have I ever done anything wrong before you, O king. Now verse 23 says, the king was overjoyed and gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted from the den, no wound was found on him because he had trusted in his God. No wound was found on him because he was a good man. No wound was found on him because he had money. No wound was found on him because he was honest in his dealings for Darius. No wound was found on him because he was an old man and the lions had pity on him. No wound was found on him because he was Jewish and lions don't like Jewish people. No. No wound was found on him because he had trusted God. All right? He did the one thing that was required. He believed in the one that God sent. Now, the language here calls for an ongoing, like an unfinished sort of a thing. In other words, he had a moment-by-moment faith. Moment-by-moment faith. It was a conscious decision each moment of the night to trust God. Not because of what God was doing, but in spite of what he could see with his own eyes in front of him. And so he's the one who probably is the prototype for the verse in one of Paul's letters that says, we live by faith, not by sight. In 2 Corinthians 4, he says, we don't look at and get distracted by what we see, because what we see is temporary. We focus on what we cannot see, because what we cannot see is eternal. Daniel had every right to be scared to death. He had every right because it was staring him right in the face, but he trusted God, and there was not a wound on him because of it. Verse 24, at the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den along with their wives and children. That is kind of harsh, but Jewish law and also Persian law says that if you falsely accuse somebody, then you get the penalty that your accusation would have brought them had it proven true. That was the law. If you brought false witness against somebody, you got to pay the penalty that the crime you accused them of bears. Yes, it is. It held down on the false accusations quite substantially. And before they reached the floor of the den, all the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones, which proves that they were really hungry lions. They hadn't been put to sleep. They weren't full of... That's right. That's right. And there was no other food over in the dark that we didn't see. They were hungry all night long, and they ate all the people that got thrown in after Daniel came out. Verse 25. And then King Darius wrote to all the people, nations, and men of every language throughout the land, may you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel. For he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will not be destroyed, and his dominion will never end. He rescues and he saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth, and he has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions. It seems like it to me that Darius was persuaded through this, which might have been the whole reason for it. I'm certain he read every document twice before he signed it from that point on. And so Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian, because, you know, Darius was the number two guy. Cyrus was the head of things. And some translations say Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius, even the reign of Cyrus the Persian. And other translations say that is the reign of Cyrus the Persian, whichever you want to put it. The idea is that the two reigned together, and so Cyrus was the head of the whole Persian Empire. Darius was the head of Babylon, one of the conquered nations. All right, so that sees us through the end of the chapter. What we get from this is that it appears that Darius may have become a believer through through this experience. As we read through his declaration. But the major point here, the major issue is, what was the basis for Daniel's survival through that ordeal? And it was his faith. It was his faith in God. And we have every right to have the same kind of faith. We have every right to have just as strong a faith. In fact, we have a responsibility to nurture and to develop that kind of faith. And how do we do that? We trust God. Now, Daniel didn't start off by spending the night in a room full of hungry lions. That was not the initial test of his faith. He had lived a long life, but his life had been characterized by his faith. He'd started small with small steps of faith, and as he achieved and saw the smaller steps, his faith grew. And you know, that's the way it has been in most of the generations. It's only in the last few hundred years that mankind has begun to trust other things. People used to trust God for healing. Now they trust the medical community. They used to trust God for provision. Now they trust their employer or their government. They used to trust in one another. Now they look to the government. You know, even in the 200 years of this country's history, we didn't start off trusting the government for our protection. We didn't start off trusting the government for our sustenance. We didn't start off trusting the government for our livelihood. We didn't start off trusting the government for our retirement. We didn't start off trusting the government for our medical expenses. That's not the way this country started. These things have been added, and as they have been added, our faith has shifted from faith in God to faith in our nation, to faith in our society, to faith in our government, to faith in our way in life. you name it. You put any title on you want to, except it isn't God. Because we as a nation don't trust God anymore. We as a people, most of us individually, don't really have to trust God for very much at all, do we? Because we got so much stuff that's guaranteed us or that's coming our way or that we know is coming that it doesn't take much faith to live anymore. We don't have lions and bears and things like that outside our houses trying to steal us away. And so we have lost this, but there's no reason we can't have the faith of Daniel. Daniel was a remarkable person, but he didn't have a faith that is not available to the rest of us. He had a faith that he had nurtured. He had a faith that he had exercised. He had a faith that he had grown through his life until it came to a point where he could withstand this kind of a test. And it was a strong faith, because don't they say that animals can detect a fear in you? We send off signals, don't we, based on what we're thinking. And so you're right, Daniel sat there and he knew in his heart that they weren't going to attack him. And so because of that, he didn't send off any fear signals, because they would have picked up on that. Because I bet you the other people they threw in next morning, they sent off fear signals, didn't they? And that changed everything.
Thanks for listening to this study. For more free Bible study resources, visit gracethroughfaith.com.